Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. I'm watching the Masters right now as we record this. Joining me on the other end of the line, Ramsey Russell. And another Ramsey, Bradley Ramsey. Guys, how are y'all?
Doing good, Rocky.
Oh, I'm surviving. I'm surviving. At least I'm not watching golf.
Oh, God, dog. I'm glad I ain't watching golf. Man, life is good because I ain't watching golf.
Yeah, exactly.
Ramsey, I got to ask you, have you talked to Forrest yet?
No, I haven't talked to him yet. He's probably driving. Thankfully, that I know of, he doesn't text too much when he drives. But how'd y'all turkey hunt go this morning?
Forrest told me this. He said, listen, the only for sure thing in turkey hunting is when you think you got it for sure, it'll never happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We set up on some turkeys. I don't like hunting turkeys like this, but we set up on some turkeys that I've kind of patterned. They're doing the same thing every single day, and this was the perfect day. Windy. They love sitting up in the corner of a field. And there's two gobblers. It was the only place that I thought that Forrest and I, which is Ramsey's son, for those that don't know, we could double up and kill two turkeys at once. And anyway, didn't work out that way. I said, come on, let's just, this wind blowing this hard, we'll find some sitting in the edge of a field, you know, because they're not going to sit in the woods on a windy day. They've got to get out in the field because they can't hear anything in the woods when it's this windy. But they've got to get out and be able to see, and especially with leaves on the trees now, it even pushes them out there more. And sure enough, we come around the corner, and it is a flock sitting in another spot. Now, imagine this in your mind. We're coming, just say these turkeys are at 1 o'clock. You can come in from one side of them and get up on them. You can come on from the other side. They're down in the bottom, straight in front of us at 1 o'clock. And both ways going around is 45 minutes walking. It's a long ways. I said, Forrest, small chance. It's some woods that kind of fell off towards them. I said, let's just walk to the edge of those woods, the point, and we'll call to them and see if they'll. Three gobblers. Usually there's one, you know, boss gobbler, and then you got kind of like elk. You know, you got the herd bulls, and then you got those satellite bulls that kind of just roam around trying to pick off a cow as she comes off the herd. And that's the same way with turkeys. And sure enough, man, I'll tell you this, and Forrest is going to hear this, but I didn't think there was any chance. I just kind of leaned back, and I said, Forrest, go to town. And, man, he pulled – and I'm going to tell you something. Forrest is a heck of a hunter, Ramsey. A heck of a hunter. And he pulls out that slate call. He called twice. And he called these turkeys 400 yards across a wide-open field to us. Didn't kill them. They disappeared. The we were on the right edge of the point, and they disappeared on the left side of it, and Forrest kind of eased up after they had went and seen them, and they just kept walking past us. I guess that wind was blowing so hard that they walked up to us within 20 yards of us, and we didn't even know it, and they just went the opposite way. It was nuts. I mean, we should have killed them.
That's turkey hunting.
Man. Well, that's turkey hunting. Yeah, that's just hunting, you know. And I'll tell you this about him calling and doing his turkey hunting thing. He didn't learn that. That's something he did not learn from his daddy. That's just something he poured his heart into and figured out on his own. So I'm proud of him, you know. And that's good to hear. Well, at least y'all had some action. That sure beats not hearing a turkey or, you know, watching turkeys 400 yards away.
I'll say this, and I'm not saying this just because Forrest is probably going to listen to this, and just because you're on the line, Ramsey. He's a woodsman. He's got it. Most people, I turkey hunt with a lot of people just because I love going. Not the best turkey hunter in the world, but man, I love going and doing it. But you notice little things about turkey hunters, and you know Forrest is real. Real easy in his movements, and you got to be that way turkey hunting. You can't be herky jerky. Turkey, man. We were talking, Forrest and I were talking about it this morning. A turkey, when they see, it's almost like them looking through a set of binoculars. That's how they see. But of course, their eyes are set on the sides of their heads, of course. But that's how good and clear and crisp they see. So you got to be slow in your movements. You know. Really, really slow, and I was just noticing that about him. You know, he's really, really careful, and so he's a great. Like I said, he's a woodsman. I'll give him that. He was taught well.
Well, I ain't gonna let it go to his head. I'll keep him humble next time I see him.
We're going back Tuesday. We don't kill these suckers, man. We don't get out there in the dark.
You know, y'all
right
almost got the shot today, but when he was playing Little League Baseball, I used to tell him, you know what almost means? Because they'd almost win, or he'd almost hit a home run, or he'd almost steal base. And I'd say, well, you know what almost means, don't you? Means you didn't. But you know, that reminds me, you talking about getting so close and not killing it. And I'm not a turkey hunter, so I my old buddy Justin Harrison, everybody knows Gator, but I told him one time, I said, I just can't get mad at those turkeys. He says, that's because you hadn't hunted the right turkey yet, Ramsey. He said, I promise you, if you ever get on the right turkey, you'll be mad at a hornet. And there may be some truth to that. So I know Forrest is probably mad at that turkey he didn't get a shot at today.
That is a true statement. Leave it to old Justin to bring out a lot of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so when we left the podcast last week, you know, I said we were going to bring some good information. Ramsey and I kind of talked pre-podcast last week, but, you know, we talked about something totally different. But Ramsey, usually before we start recording, we'll talk 30 or 45 minutes. And I say, yeah, that's kind of the direction we need to go in today. That'll be good. That's what we need to do. Well, we kind of found a direction last week, and then Ramsey said, you know, a couple of months ago, I was sitting in the Kroger parking lot waiting on the need to come out of Kroger, and I wrote this list. And I said, what's on this list, Ramsey? He said, 10 changes, 10, or is it 10 or 12?
Oh, it's just changes in general. It keeps going, you know.
Changes in general that have happened in this part of the world. Listen, this isn't a outside of corn. Sitting in a Flyway Federation Bang Them Away podcast.
We started talking last week, and I don't know how we ended up on that subject about hunting pressure and stuff like it. And you know, it's you hear corn. Well, maybe it ain't gonna be corn this year because the Midwest is flooded. Corn take what, 120, 130 days to get right. They ain't gonna get it this year. The corn belt is what they call it? A cyclone went off in there, cyclone bomb. And
bomb cyclone,
man,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, a bomb cyclone. So but you know, even if corn in the Midwest does play a role in the timing of the migration, or in the fact that big Canadas and mallards hold up longer, even if it does, you know, I think it's a lot of different reasons, and I'm glad Bradley's on here, cause, you know, Bradley knows a lot of this stuff. He's been hunting a long time, but I'd say to the list, a list of all the changes and all the reasons that may have affected migratory birds coming to the deep south, especially in a warm winter. You know, boy, I mean, Pat Pitt, Bill Cooksey, any of your guests in the past could add items to this list. And, you know, I'm not saying my list, but, you know, all this discussion, because all you see, you know, somebody could be talking about a new pair of camo Crocs on Duck South, and it somehow turns to corn in the Midwest. And, you know, and it just, I was just sitting there just kind of minding my own business one day, and they did run in to get something at the grocery, and I just started typing list in notes, and it's what I call free streaming. You know, just everything that pops in my mind connects, and that way I've got it. And, you know, I kind of broke it into habitat quality, habitat quantity, hunting pressure, and we talked a lot about it last week, climatic changes. And I'm not saying the word global warming, but for the last several years, you can't deny some fact of climate change. Look what's going on in Alaska. Look what's going on around the world. And you know, breeding trends and how all these factors with land use practices have affected the breeding grounds in the Dakotas up in Canada. And just remember, folks, Canada doesn't have the U.S. Department of Agriculture via commodity prices and controls manipulating how and what, where and when they plant. Buddy, it is nothing but the railroads and the farmer and God up there farming. You know, it is like farming back in the 1800s. And Forrest and I were eating lunch. They had my favorite day at the reservoir up at Shuckers the other day. They had 50-cent oysters. They have it three times a year, and they got good oysters. Really good. I don't know if it's how they manage them or where they get them, but they got good oysters, and I yell calf rope at about six dozen. But Forrest got to telling me about a class he had up at State. I don't know what the class was or why they were talking about it, but they got to talking about, he said, well, did you know that in the last 25 years that half, based on reef surveys in the ocean, the whole ocean, not the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, but the whole ocean body of water, that the fishery had declined 50%. Wow. I'm like, wow, that's, and I listened to a lady on, an attractive lady that does a lot of scuba diving around the world. I listened to her on Joe Rogan, and she was talking about some of these cultures over in Italy and Greece, that their whole culture is fishing, and as far as those boats can sail now, that just the local fishermen can go, they've absolutely depleted the fishery resource. And so, just in preparation for this trip, this conversation with Bradley, I just looked it up, and I graduated college in 1994, 25 years ago. And again, I saw somebody post up the other day, one of the old Duck South members post up that 50% of atmospheric carbon had accreted just in the last 25 years. So I said, okay, 25 years. In the last 25 years, half the ocean's been depleted. There's all this atmospheric carbon now that I don't know nothing about, nothing of that, except just to quote them numbers. But I did go look this up. You know, since I graduated college 25 years ago, the world population has increased 27%. There's now 7.7 billion people on Mother Earth with a hungry mouth to feed. And the U.S. population has increased 20% since I graduated college. There's now 328.6 million people just in the continental United States. And, you know, you just got to ask yourself, how has that affected it? What? How much more asphalt and concrete? How, you know, now there's a trend for people to start moving to cities.
Yeah.
But there's still neighborhoods. Y'all know this, and we'll talk about this in another podcast, but I'll just say this, and I'm going to shut up and let y'all talk for a minute. But, for example, my first ever away from Mississippi duck hunt, that really was the hunt that started it all, my path of worldwide travel and all, was I'd always read, and some folks call it study hall, some folks call it detention. But I'd always look through them magazines and seen those pictures of snow goose hunting down the Katy Prairie. And a friend of a friend type recommendation, I went down there back in 92 or 93 and did a snow goose hunt in the fall. The limit was 5 snow geese. And boy, just about every time I went, half the time I went, I went for several years, we could have shot way more than 5. But we'd shoot our specs, and we'd shoot our 5 snow geese, and it really kicked off my idea that it's duck season somewhere. But I wrote a blog, back when blogs were a big thing, about this hunt and how times had changed since I started doing that, because at the time, you would see those snow goose roosts down that prairie numbering in the 50s to hundreds of thousands of snow geese rolling around. And somebody from Texas, a young man, wrote me up and said, "Mr. Russell, I'd love for you and your son to come down and snow goose hunt with us." This was just 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. Boys were just in high school. And he said, "Come down and hunt with us. We got a good hunt. We're old school. We put out the sticks and the rags, and we mouth call and blow. You know, we don't use electronic calls and all this. And we got a pretty dang good roost." And I went on down there to, I think, Wharton. And, man, the geese rolled off that roost one day, and there were 5 or 6 thousand geese. I mean, it was a fraction of the number it had been. And what I had talked about in that blog was how water rights, and Bradley probably knows a lot more about this than me, but the Lower Mississippi Colorado River Association or somebody, the way they manage water, the way they can farm rice down there. Now, how they farm rice, if they can farm rice, if they can irrigate it, has all changed. And the most historic fabled goose roost on the Katy Prairie years ago is now have been paved over, and it's one of these mega shopping malls in the Houston community. Not just a little shopping mall, but a mega shopping mall. Now,
yeah, it's a huge change down there.
My whole point in this tirade is, you know what? My granddaddy and my daddy and uncle, when they were little boys hunting with my granddaddy back in the 50s and 60s, the good old days, times change. And why we aren't killing birds in any given blind that our granddaddies or our ancestors killed birds could be for a whole lot more reasons than farming practices in any given state or geography, especially with corn. I've got my own thoughts on that. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's for a lot of different reasons because you know, humanity's first priority is to feed itself. That's just, you know, humanity has to eat. And the truth of the matter is, not everybody eats wild game, but even if they did, there wouldn't be enough wild game to feed folks.
Oh, no.
And you know, but things have changed. And I just just sitting in the parking lot about 30, 45 minutes one day, I just started making a little old list of things, you know, of reasons I think have changed. The other things, you know, the things have changed. So I thought it'd be a good discussion.
You know, Ramsey, I've seen the same. You know, this coming year will be 40 seasons for me, and I'm fortunate to have my dad's records going back. And he, too, went to the Katy Prairie. And I remember him telling me stories about it and you know, the goose roost down there. And having worked in the oil and gas industry, I've traveled through that area a lot. And you're right, it is changed. It's not the giant rice prairie that it used to be. It's a suburb basically now.
Mm, yeah.
That's a huge change. I can remember seeing the first group of snow geese I ever saw in Mississippi Delta was right outside of Holly Bluff, Mississippi. On one farmer up there at the time grew rice. And it wasn't a massive geese. It was, you know, all maybe between 500 and 1,000. This is back in my early 80s. And my dad pointed them out to me because they were unusual for the Mississippi Delta at that time. They didn't come that far south. And that's a huge change we've seen in our lifetime, just in our local area. The landscape scale changes that we've seen, in not only in agriculture, but industrialization, and like I said, with water rights, farming practices, have got to have an impact on what we see in our local area.
Yep. We started this conversation off, or ended our last discussion, Rocky, talking about hunting pressure. And I've said this, that duck hunting, us going to a blind, it has a people component to it. Okay, and it just, every duck hunt, it's not just shooting a duck, there's a people component to it. And I love that component of it. But you know, when we talk about hunting pressure, like we wrapped up last week's conversation, we're talking about a people component. And one thing that I thought of after we talked last time, and I made a note, you know, look at how people have changed. Just the hunting pressure, the amount we hunt, the culture, the religion of duck hunting versus my granddaddy's day. And I thought of another thing about that, and it's just going to lead into it, is I remember listening to one of your podcasters talking about shooting squirrels going back and forth to school, and he'd pick up pop bottles to go buy a few shotgun shells. And back in those days, you know, most folks just loaded a few shells or bought a few shells and went duck hunting. The limit was, you know, 3 to 10 ducks. You shooting lead back in the good old days. And
oh, yeah.
During the point system, it probably lasts 3 ducks. You know, how many shells did you really need? But I even asked myself, how many times do I go to the duck blind, even though I'm just shooting 6 ducks? How many times do I go to the duck blind with less than a full belt? 25. How many guys do you know go to the duck blind with 2 or 3 boxes?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's just ammo. Bam, 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 bam. And, you know, and all these 3.5-inch shells we're shooting, day back in the day, we shot 2 3/4-inch lead Mohawk, man. I mean, 7.5. You know, they'd kill a squirrel and a rabbit heartbeat. But you know, the range was kind of limited. And now, you know, marketing has convinced people that you could knock a duck off the dang moon if you get the lead right and kill it. So you know, people have changed, but boy, when you start looking at the change of landscape, you know, like what has changed? And I don't know. I don't know acres. I don't know quantify. But if you start talking habitat quantity, you know, just the amount of habitat, more people, even though hunters have declined, the remaining hunters are now hunting in a more focused geography than we used to
be
hunting in.
Ramsey, you mentioned the number of shells, but I'll also say, you know, you know who my father was, and he was, you know, known, him and his clan were known as some of the most diehard duck hunters in the South Delta of Mississippi. But when I look back through his notes, they went whenever they could, but there was not the whole, I hunted 60 days out of a season. I mean, the season was
exactly right.
They hunted the weekend.
It wasn't a religion then. Yeah.
They hunted the weekends, maybe a long weekend over the holidays somewhere. But my father principally hunted Friday, but always Saturday and Sunday. But the expectation now has become, if you only hunt weekends, well, you're just a weekend warrior. You're not a duck hunter. You're not a diehard.
Yeah. You ain't serious about it.
That multiplies the pressure. And there wasn't many people that were more diehard about it than my father, Howard Miller. Gerald Braddock, those guys had some of the best duck land in the South Delta. But they didn't try to hunt 60 days because they also knew that they couldn't sustain that kind of pressure. The birds.
But even if a man does just hunt weekends in Mississippi, chances are he goes to Canada for a week. He might take his kids out to Kansas. He might freelance in Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
Boy, Heidi, it's not just me traveling around the U.S. and burning miles. I mean, there's a lot of folks hunting a lot of different areas, hunting different flyways, hunting different species, and cumulatively. You know, now we're chasing snow geese all the way back up into Canada. You know, way back up into Canada, which we're targeting white geese, not the other ones. But how can we do that without disturbing the other birds? I mean,
even back as far as the 2004, 2005, when I was running that magazine, we talked about the fact that the number one thing short-stopping ducks was steel shot, because people became mobile hunters. In the day, back in my father's day, it was rare for them to travel to hunt. They might go for a day or two up to Illinois to try to goose hunt. They might go out. If they traveled, they were going to do something different. They'd go pheasant hunting in Kansas. But the majority of people you see, at least on social media, even the majority of people in my circle, travel every year to duck hunt to get a few extra days in.
Sure.
And
I get
since AHM came in, with 60-day season, these birds are shot from the time they get shell off their beak to the time they turn back. So that pressure's got to have an effect on on what we see.
Well, my granddaddy's era and generation were a lot more practical people. Rock, it's funny. I listened to old Jeff Foles, and I, you know, three times now at least I've heard him say that's back when a dollar was a dollar. You know, and it's funny he should say that, because I'm that guy that might be watching a cowboy show or something, you know, or watching Pablo Escobar series, and they start talking money numbers in 1970, and I wonder how much it'd be worth in today's time base. I look at my little inflation calculator, and it's amazing. Okay, and what I'm saying, back in my granddaddy's day, I just wonder what the man would say. I just wonder what he'd say back with his mindset, and those mindset back in the, you know, Depression era all the way up through the 70s. I wonder what he would say about me jumping on a plane, flying halfway across the world to go shoot ducks, or to drive to Canada to go shoot ducks, or to drive to Oklahoma and burning three tanks of gas to go shoot ducks. I know what he'd say. You're a fool. He wasn't that mindset, son. But you know, times have changed. A dollar ain't really a dollar no more. That's back in the day. Yep. You could buy Orange Crush for 5 cents. Now it's $1.50. I mean, you know, everything has changed. And the whole mindset has changed, and it has increased the amount of pressure on the resource. I really don't know how they, the biologists and the experts and the scientists, decide 360 ducks, you know, six ducks times 60 days, 360 ducks for the state of Mississippi if you hunted every day. But like Foles said yesterday, they probably don't expect you to really do that. There probably ain't enough ducks for everybody to go out and do that. But man, when you look at the toll, the cumulative toll on the resource, young birds, if you're going up north to hunt, and across the flyways, it is significantly higher today than it was then. And at the same time, to transition into another bullet point of what things may have changed is habitat quantity. And here are just some bullet points. They just free stream, no random, you know, random order, everything else was fewer acres across the landscape. You've got clump distribution. In the state of Mississippi, Delta Wildlife looked at some data, and by their numbers, based on the past 10 years, it's shocking. I like, what? They said there's actually more ducks in the state of Mississippi now than there were 10 years ago, not including last year, folks. I'm talking about a regular year. But what they're seeing by the numbers is it's a lot more clump distribution. You know, parts of this county or that county where there's a lot more water on the landscape. Other parts of the Delta, you know, are not as much water, which, and so in no particular order here, you know, consider how ag economics and the global agricultural economic factor has changed. You know, for example, I can just think of one county or one parish, they call it, up in northeast Louisiana. They pulled 66 pit blinds out of 2 or 3 years ago because these farmers have realized the economics of it. Hey, when I put water on my fields in the fall for duck hunters, it creates a frangipane that I've got to go in and disc the spring, which delays me getting my next year's crop in by 6 to 8 weeks, which means I make less money on the return of that. So,
yeah, one of my farmers up in actually just north of where you're talking about, broke it down economics wise for me, and he said it cost him $100 an acre to leave water standing on a field, not just the cost of pumping it. $100 an acre. He said, I can't lease my pits for that. Average field 80 to 100 acres. He said, I'll never get that money back. I'll never recoup it. and he pulled 14 pits 2 years ago.
It's just simple economics. It's simple economics. Farmers are the hardest working people. They've got a very big job to go out and feed the world's mouths. You know what I'm saying? But it's simple economics. And we've always talked about the commodity value of waterfowl as it affects the future of hunting. There you go. And you know what? Talking about competing with agriculture commodity, this brings up my another little bullet point somewhere on here. Look at how the commodity value of agriculture affected CRP up in the plains. Now down here in the deep south, CRP means hardwood trees. Up on the prairie pothole region, it's grasslands. That's where a lot of birds have been nesting. A lot of our ducks have been nesting when the Dakotas are wet, and the commodity value got corn and things of that nature got so high, they said, you know what? I'm going to buy out of my CRP contract because I can make more money planting agriculture than I can letting it sit here fallow for 15 or 20 years. You follow what I'm saying? How do we compete with that?
And that's one of the big ones that we have staring down us right now is the loss of CRP acreage and the associated dense nesting cover as far as future populations of waterfowl go. We've lost a lot of that cover.
Take that up and take that up to Canada, where they don't have USDA offsets. They've just got what I can produce in a good year and get to the depot, to get to the elevator on the railroad, and that's how I make my living. Heck yeah, when they hit a drought, they're going to get further down the slope, and they're going to take in some of those potholes because there's a few more acres, and you can't blame a man for trying to make a living. These people ain't retiring rich. They're making livings, you know. So,
absolutely.
But it just bears to think how things have changed in the last quarter century. And I really thought the boy from Delta Waterfowl talking about what one of the factors that affected us last year was a decrease in juvenile birds. Okay, productivity, total number of birds up on the prairie potholes in Canada, less young birds. Cumulatively, how it affects what we're seeing down here in the deep south. Other things about habitat quantity would be, you know, they've tiled a lot of fields. Man, look at the river gauge on Greenville, Mississippi, on Vicksburg, Mississippi, and all up and down the Mississippi Flyway right now. That's all got to do with the tiling of fields in that big, massive watershed that covers 40% of the continental U.S. that lets them get in there and do more agriculture. But on the backside of this, look at the increased channelization going on up and down. The Corps of Engineers and the backwater flooding, it's changed not only the total drainage. You know, back in Nash Buckingham or even further back, Mark Twain's day, when they talked about the Mississippi River being a big, bad, gnarly river, it was still a wild river. There was near the volume coming down. It is right now. It is a big, dangerous, deep, massive pipe of water volume coming down through there right now. It's spreading out in between those levees. The amount of habitat, yeah, there's still some habitat at times, but not the habitat quality that it was. And look how it's beginning to affect with backwater flooding in the South Delta, with flooding all the way up the main Mississippi corridor right now. How that's all starting to back up and affect crops and more soil quality habitat. Because you know what? When it floods during duck season, you got 6 or 10 or 15 or 20 foot of water sitting on a field. Ain't no ducks feeding in there, son. They need inches a foot to feed. It's cumulative is what I'm pointing out. You know, I'm not saying this is the main reason. I'm saying it's a reason. We already talked about increased civilization. I talked about water use, talking about turkey, talking about Texas water rights and things of that nature. But I read a book a client gave me, and I can't quote the title of that, but it's like 100 Years of Texas Duck Hunting. I can't quote the title of the author because it's sitting by my bed over at camp right now. But, you know, that book was talking about, and I had no idea, that over on the east side of Galveston Bay, up against the Louisiana line in southeast Texas, what a incredible rice agricultural history used to be there and duck hunting tradition. That's been gone forever, folks. Now, how did that? How would having tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of acres of rice right down there across the border from Lake Arthur, Lake Charles, how would that affect that part of Louisiana? Guarantee it affects how ducks are behaving and where ducks are going and where ducks and geese are eating and doing things. And finally, increased sedimentation. You know, you start looking at the way drainage is being done, and I'm thinking deep south, and I'm thinking personal, is you know, floodplain development. You've got cypress breaks, and you start going on up the slope till you got good old cotton land. It used to be in cane breaks back in the historic delta. And those low-lying places are heavy clay, and especially in face of agriculture and urbanization, you've got sedimentation runoff that's going to collect in the lowest place, and that's going to be a lot of these cypress breaks, a lot of these low-lying areas that we think of as breaks down here in the deep south, and how increased sedimentation affects the vegetation community, how it affects water quality. You know, Nash Buckingham used to talk about going up there around Swan Lake and some of those areas. Anybody that's ever hunted up in that lake, Beaver Dam, they used to hunt. It's a big old cypress break. Beautiful. It's gorgeous. You still kill ducks up there. Back in his day, all that understory was all button bush. It was all button bush. And it was cover. It would cover out of the elements, out of the wind. They could swim up in and not worry about hawks and eagles eating them. And now it's primarily cypress. And there's a lot of public lands, cypress break type areas around the state of Mississippi that are the same condition. It's cypress sitting there, but very, very little other woody component there. That's because of sedimentation. All because of sedimentation. Ooh. When they go and build a dam for a major reservoir, there's a lot of sediment coming down that waterway that's settling into these breaks downriver. Increase quantity, and it's also quality.
Yeah, we also don't see the, you know, it's hard for people that haven't hunted these areas, you know, and like I said, I'm 40 years into it, but I've watched breaks that I've hunted them all my life change, not only from the woody vegetation perspective, but when you're dealing with runoff of fertilizers and things like that, the water quality changes, the water clarity changes, your plant base changes. I've seen places change from mallard holes to gadwall holes just because of the food base in there. And
the gar holes.
Yeah, the gar holes.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many layers to what. One of the things I tell clients when I'm dealing with habitat is there's no such thing anymore as a walkaway wetland, because we have changed the runoff in the landscape so much that you can't just put water on it and it's a duck hole. It is an instrument that will sit there and degrade over time, and we have changed so much in agriculture and civilization and water runoff and all of these things and farming practices around these areas, these toll birds, that we, like you said, we fragmented our habitat so much that you're putting the same or greater number of ducks into a smaller area, which increases pressure. And your overall food base has reduced in our area in the Delta because of the change in genetics of crops, so that they're getting harvested earlier. The fields are getting dried or they're getting leveled off and they're not holding water in swags and swales anymore. So you concentrated these birds in the areas where they can be pressured.
There you go. And you know, the last item I've got in terms of quantity, and I've also got this under quality, is that Louisiana marsh down there, downriver, the lower Mississippi Delta. Bill Cooksey could talk. I bet he could talk for 10 podcasts about all the science and the numbers and the quality and the whys and the what fors. But that is a massive, massive resource. And it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter that you're on the western side of the state and Venice Delta's down here on this side of the state. It doesn't matter that I'm 4.5-5 hours north hunting the South Delta, Mississippi, and that's 5 hours south of me. You know, we don't know how the tremendous loss of quality and quantity of coastal marsh is affecting the entire flyway. You know, because I do know this. I do know that in places I've hunted in Mississippi and Arkansas, in a normal year, towards the end of the season, you get a major backflux of green wings and gadwalls and pintails. You know, now if those birds aren't going down there, if they're holding back up because, you know, and it really is, it's scary. It's scary how fragile that resource is, that there's been such a loss of marsh to lay down tidal surge miles out from this habitat now that a good hard south wind, it doesn't take a hurricane. It takes just a big saltwater surge coming in to knock out lots of good duck food and duck habitat. And for whatever reason, they're also combating a weevil now that is destroying a lot of roseocane that is holding what soil there is right now. And again, it goes back to the Corps of Engineers, a lot of these different practices. They've changed the direction of the river. You know, it's not going through the Atchafalaya Basin, but they're not. You know, there's really not what needs to be in place to keep replenishing that soil down there, so that the marsh just holds, let alone expands like it used to. You know, I tell you what, back when I was in college, all the hippies talking about save the rainforest. Man, what I call that Louisiana marsh, but it's properly the lower delta. It is a very, very fragile global resource that really is not on very many people's attention. It's really not on many people's radar. And, you know, so, I mean, boy, I ain't even got started with my list right now, Rocky, but you see, just throw all that together. And why has things changed in the last 25 years? Why has duck hunting changed in the last 25 years? When you throw that together as a piece of a puzzle, how could it not have changed?
So you got a few more interesting ones that I had on my list.
Well, we'll get into it. I'm just going free stream habitat quality. No particular area, but maybe this one came up first and foremost because my background is bottomland hardwood silviculturalist. That was my major. That's what I did for the government starting off. That was just what I wrote a lot of scientific presentations and papers and research and things of that nature on. But you know, a big hot issue last year had to be around green tree reservoirs and you know, out of state hunters and things of that nature. Forget that. What I'm getting into is another issue. And I'm not well read on it. It's only so much a man can read on social media and stuff like that. But it's a big major issue just in the state of Arkansas when they started talking about drying up some of these public green tree reservoirs for a period of time, going in and doing some timber thinnings and beginning to let those soils oxidize for a good period of time. The important thing is, you know, it's way past due to ensure quality beyond my lifetime, beyond my son's lifetime, for future generations, for the ducks themselves. It's way past time. But at the same time, you know, boy, you get into that human element. You know, I never forget one post. A guy said, great. You know, I understand that this needs to be done for habitat, but I need somewhere to raise my kids to hunt right now. Now that punches me in the stomach. You know what I'm saying? Because heck yeah, at a time that we need children out there to have opportunities and places to hunt, boy, I mean, you know, acres you take away and do right. And here's what's going on for folks that don't quite understand. You know, it's all got to do with soil hydrology. And unfortunately, I ain't bragging on this, but I just happen to take enough soil class at the dang near get a minor in soils when I was up in Mississippi State. It's very important to hardwood silviculture management. And, you know, think about this. In an average green tree reservoir, an average hardwood bottom, you know, you've got oak trees, but you've got good oak trees and bad oak trees when it comes to ducks eating. You got little cherry bark oak and water oak and willow oak acorns. You've got them great big old gnarly overcup that ducks don't eat. Deer and bear will eat them. Ducks don't eat them. They can't. They can't choke one down if they tried to. But it across the spectrum of a floodplain, and we're talking inches or feet in water difference and clay difference and soil saturation difference, soil hydrology, let's call it. You know, you got the overcups that have wet feet, and you've got the cherry bark and the water oaks and the willow oaks, no desirable species. They've got relatively dry feet. Okay, so as you go further and deeper down the floodplain, looking at a graph, you know, from left to right, you get into more coarse species. Well, then you've also got this whole dynamic of forest management. Oaks aren't a climax species. They're mid-climax. They come in when the light, they come in right behind the willows and the cottonwoods and the little filtered light in. And then they begin to transition. Well, behind them are bitter pecans and pecans and species, tree species that have no food value really for waterfowl other than leaf cover, which generates your invertebrates. And, you know, and it's a scientific fact that after 30, 45 days of water sitting on a site, your invertebrate quality goes down. So, you know, if you look at the best duck hunting, flooded timber hunting in Arkansas, I've said this forever, it's public land. And it ain't available every year because that river's got to jump up. Natural.
Right.
Got to jump up. It spread out, and then it goes back down. You know what I'm saying? And that's what, you know, to keep that green tree reservoir, to keep those trees healthy, to ensure that desirable species replace as those trees die of old age, as they're logged, as a tornado or ice storm comes through, to ensure that red oak comes back up in the canopy, for a lot of different reasons, you've got to pull that water down and mimic cycles. You know, the Corps of Engineers will not let you build a green tree reservoir and flood it more than 1 out of 3 years. And some of the best hunting areas I'm aware of, you know, natural ebb and flow of river systems, they may not flood for 5 years. So you got this healthy forest ecosystem out there for waterfowl. My whole point in that whole subject is just to say that a lot of green tree reservoirs, not only in the state of Arkansas, but also Mississippi and Louisiana, quality has declined in the past 25 years because they need to flood it for public use. They need to impound it. There's been political pressure to do things. There's been political, I mean, boy, you want to talk about a civil war breaking out at the prospect of them taking places that have been hunted for 2 or 3 generations out of rotation and drying them up so that they can go in there and do some forest maintenance on them. Okay. It habitat quality has declined. And those green tree reservoirs, I'm going to throw out its habitat quality again, that South Louisiana marsh. I don't know how important it is to the entire Mississippi Flyway, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say, personally speaking, I have a whole lot of bias going into it. I think it's very, very important. I think it's like the crown jewel of the southern part of the flyway is that Louisiana marsh down there. And what has changed since the 1970s in the Mississippi Delta and Arkansas and all this part of the world I live in? Zero grade fields. Okay, it's more water out there if the farmer decides to pump it. But is it quality water? Look at the, and let's get into this. Let's get into clean farming practices, because most efficient and better farming, higher yields per acre, less weeds. Higher grade at the elevator, less weed seed, less noxious weed seed, more Roundup ready. Look at what's going on with the cultivars of rice, of beans, of any crop we've got. Boy, they say that wheat today is causing a lot of human ailments. I ain't going to get into that. I don't know enough about it. But we do know that the genetic structure of wheat to produce more yield is not the wheat that the ancient Romans ate. It's a whole lot different than what we ate just back in the 70s. The nutritive value maybe has changed. Soybeans, I tell you what, I hunt all over the earth for ducks. And I never hunt soybeans unless I'm in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi. And it's terrible. It's terrible. You know, these soybeans today rot 30 days in the water. They sprout on the vine after a couple of good heavy rains if they're left out there. And at best, even the good old soybeans of yesteryear, you know, there's something about that soybean that unless you heat it and break down its chemical structure, there's relatively little nutritive value. I mean, it's ideally suited for making dashboards and Chevrolet pickup trucks. It's like feeding ducks slim fast, but because they really aren't getting a lot of protein and fat out of it unless it's been heated and called something called tofu. And we ain't feeding ducks tofu. We're feeding them third, fourth, fifth generation soybeans. Good for farming, good for what the world needs, not too good for ducks. Okay? Our more efficient harvest. I mean, how much? I don't know. I'm not a farmer, guys, but I guarantee you there's a whole lot more grain being gleaned with these $1 million cultivators than there were back in the good old days. I mean, you know, I saw somewhere not too long ago a picture of the first dead gum cotton picker, you know, mechanical cotton picker, you know, and I can't believe it in my lifetime. It was tiny, and it was old school, and I can remember seeing them little old things, little brown and white ones sitting out there in the fields, and you still see one every now and again sitting on the edge of a field that just died there, and they moved over the edge of the field and buried it, so to speak, but clean farming practices, where they've come up, more efficient harvest. You know, I'm sitting here thinking of all these snow geese. That has to be an impact, not only to the food consumption or to the food availability, the quality availability to products out there, but just, I mean, running the ducks off. You know, you ain't going to see, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on, man. I mean, quality and quantity. What has changed technologically in the last quarter century since my grandfather was duck hunting is just immense.
You know, Randy, and talking to Rocky before this, one of the things that he and I talked about, he didn't want to give me too much insight on your list, but one of them I came up with on my own was, you know, the technology that we as hunters have access to now that my dad didn't have, that my grandfather didn't have. And that kind of rolls into an economics perspective of, you know, the free credit availability. You know, people say, oh, well, there's been marsh boats forever. Well, yeah, there has, but everybody didn't have one. In my father's day,
that's true.
The very few people had amphibious ATVs. If you didn't have something that would swim and go through mud, you didn't hunt where we hunted. A four-wheeler wouldn't get there. Now, and very few people had those types of machines. People walked hunting. People, you know, ran an outboard. The majority of duck hunters now have greater access to a reduced amount of habitat. So pressure again becomes another factor just in how we access the limited habitat we have. We have more ability now to get to anywhere a duck can be than my starting career or my father's generation had any vision of. I've joked on the podcast before about when we'd see these old swags out in the middle of a cut up bean field, there'd be ducks all in it. And we just look at them and go, well, you can't hunt those because you could not get to them. There was not a machine made that could reliably get you in there and back out in the 1980s. And today, with what we have from ATVs to surface drives, it's amazing the access we have to a reduced amount of habitat. And it's good that there again, that pressure's got to have an effect on what we see, not only in distribution, but in bird behavior down here.
It's got to. And I tell you what, I just added something to my list. You just said, because you articulated credit availability, how that has changed and what that has given access to the modern hunter, credit availability. Anybody can run a credit card and go get that mud boat or take out a little old note or go do this. Or you're right, man. You're exactly right on how it's all started changing like that. And it's, you know, and here's the deal, you know. It's not going to stop changing.
Oh, no.
You know, I tell you, do y'all know that the World Bird Dog Championships used to be held up in North Mississippi? The World Champion Bird Dog Championship were held up where Dunn's used to be up there in North Mississippi, not too far out of Memphis. And at one time, quail hunting was a massive thing in the Deep South. I mean, state of Mississippi, you know, back in Nash Buckingham's day, which we ain't talking back in the 1700s. We're talking about in the 1940s and 50s. It was massive. I can remember my wife's grandparents lived up in Webster County, had 40 acres. And they got a little bit more than that, but really, but, you know, they farmed back in the two mule and a plow days. You know what I'm saying? And Mama and Papa, they say, well, you want to eat some quail tonight for dinner? And they say, yeah. And they go walk around the property and shoot a few quail for dinner every time they wanted to. And it wasn't clean farming like it is today. It was a lot of broken up habitat. That's back. That's that generation that made America great with a hoe. With a $2 jug of Roundup. They made it with a hoe, buddy. And you know, but I just remember in school, because quail was kind of an interest of mine, you know, when I went through the wildlife program, and we had some brilliant quail folks down there when I was going through that I got to know, and they talked about how historically the state of Mississippi, for example, was a longleaf pine grasslands type community, because longleaf pine evolves in fire. Bolt the lightning hit, or the Indians light it off, it burned everything, but you know, that don't bother longleaf pine. They need it kind of to regenerate. And I heard a guy tell me one time, he'd done a lot of research on this, but he was saying, you know, it wouldn't have been nothing back in the day. A guy could gallop through some of them old longleaf pine forests, them historic virgin longleaf pine forests. You could ride at full gallop, and your biggest worry was stumbling off in a gopher tortoise hole or something, you know. But then, as civilization moved into Mississippi, the first cut, and they began to cut timber. As the railroad came through the Delta, they started accessing that Delta. And it came through the hills, it started accessing pine timber. So you had really, if you look at historically from the time Christopher Columbus landed in America to now, you had just this really little short window of time between the time that first cut in Mississippi to industrialized timber and combined with what was then dirty farming, you know, 40 acres here and kind of a lifestyle farming practice and small farms and non-industrial farm back then, to where you had this massive boom in bobwhite quail. Yep. And I know from having worked for U.S. Department of Agriculture for 15 years there in central Mississippi that you take what county was it? It was Philadelphia, Mississippi, up in that area right there. The D.C., the District Conservation, told me one time that in his career, they had reformed 90% of all the agriculture in that county, Neshoba County. 90% had gone back in the trees via USDA cost share programs. And a lot could be said throughout the whole state of Mississippi now through reforestation. And but, you know, when I look back, I'm in a little old camp down in the South Delta. It's Wetland Reserve Program. It's very, very marginal land. My grandfather, Russell, who introduced me to hunting, killed his last mallard duck on that property when it was just buckshot farming land. That's something Rocky, me and Bradley Ramsey have in common. His family used to own that farm. And
first
we still
duck
got
ever was on that farm.
First duck. Well, now, back when he was there, it was Milo and soybeans. Now it's a 25-acre hardwood plantation. I know from having worked with the federal government, I haven't seen these numbers in 20 years, but I know when we bought that piece of property that just in the state of Mississippi, from where that camp is located in the South Delta, there was nearly 300,000 acres of restored habitat that used to be marginal farmland back in the 60s and 70s that is now 10 to 30-year-old hardwood plantations, a lot of buck vine. Go across the river, Miss Arkansas, Louisiana, we're talking 1 million acres restored hardwoods that used to be that low-lying, flood-prone, flood-heavy habitat back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And so just like the bobwhite quail, you know, it could just be that those good old days back when my granddaddy hunted that farm, it really was a big window of opportunity. It could, I mean, I'm going to tell you what, 1 million acres less habitat, that's a slug, baby. That's a lot of less habitat just to be put back into hardwood trees. Just yep. In my lifetime, it's been cleared, it's been farmed, and it's been put back in hardwoods just in my lifetime. Now, why have things changed in the past 25 years? Why might farming up in Iowa or corn farming up in Nebraska not have quite the role on the amount of ducks we're seeing as compared to what Granddaddy saw? That I'm just throwing it out there. It could be for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, you know, Ramsey, the places you talk about and the places that I are in common between us, I didn't really thought about the fact that, you know, in my lifetime, in yours, we saw them go from clear-cut timber to farm, then back to trees again. And
the number of acres that I know of, just personally in my own small range that I travel in the Mississippi Delta, that are, you know, I won't say inalterably changed because it has been changed before, but are so vastly different than, you know, than the days when people called it the heyday of waterfowl down in the Delta. I mean, you're right. There's a possibility that we were looking at a Goldilocks moment. They talk about the Goldilocks zone for planets where life can be sustained, before Earth sits. We may have been seeing one of those times when the habitat and the conditions were perfect for us down here for whatever period of time you want to call it. But when you look at the scale of change from South Louisiana all the way up to the breeding grounds that's happened, it's got to have an impact on waterfowl distribution, on local hunting, and on our own perception. People that have come in and only have, you know, knowledge of the past 10, 15 years are going to see things completely differently than somebody who's seen it for 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, or that has the access to the knowledge of some of our ancestors to know what it was like here, down here in the Delta, long before the last 10, 15 years where people have, you know, social media has gotten everybody talking about these things. We talk to people now from all over the United States, whereas in my day, before social media became a thing, you talked to your local duck hunters. You didn't know what was happening somewhere else. So I think perception is also another large change that we face that, you know, just because of communication.
It is. And, you know, I will say this. I am vehemently opposed to a group that comes across as divisive and finger pointing. And I'm vehemently opposed to it. But at the same time, I do believe a lot of the discussions that are going on need to happen. We need to have this discussion collectively. But beyond the discussion, we need to act on it. You know what I'm saying? Now I'm gonna say this, and I'm just gonna throw it out there. Who is fixing or helping us with some of the habitat issues that we need that need tackling right now? Who's taking it upon themselves at all to tackle that restoration of the lower delta down there in the coastal marsh? Who? National Wildlife Federation, Ducks Unlimited. Who is restoring? Who is putting any wintering habitat in perpetual easements to protect them? Besides our federal government, who locks them up and says you can't hunt them? Who's doing that down here in the Deep South? Ducks Unlimited. Okay, you know, and I'm gonna tell you, I'm just gonna share this with you. Ducks Unlimited, the organization, the banquet, the steak dinners, buying the prints. But Ducks Unlimited, the habitat experts that are satisfying life cycle requirements from the breeding grounds to the wintering grounds. And when I was with the federal government, the Ducks Unlimited Southern Regional Office that was putting habitat on the ground, they were the best non-government office, non-GO, best partner I've ever seen. They bring knowledge, they bring skill set, they bring interest, and they bring all them banquet dollars as cost share to the table to put habitat. And to people out there criticizing, but well, that's just some rich guy's place. BS. Buddy,
absolutely.
They are putting quality habitat on the ground in the South. They're leveraging dollars to get the most out of the dollars that are bought on prints or whatever have you else. And they're locking up land, they're putting land into conservation use for perpetuity under easements, and they are bringing this best way I can put it up. It's kind of like you got the American Postal Service delivering junk mail to my office for a $5 billion deficit per year, and you got FedEx making money and doing it right. To me, that's Ducks Unlimited. And, you know, I really think that any hunter in America, and I'm trying to give Ducks Unlimited credit. I've seen what they do as a biologist on the ground, working hand in hand with them for the good of everybody. And I love and respect what they do. but I'm talking to hunters. You know what? Our $25 stamp, duck stamp, and our $150 license, that ain't enough.
No, sir.
You know, it's incumbent on all of us not only to find opportunity to take young people hunting, but to dig in our pockets. It's gonna take a whole lot more than a $25 stamp that's going into nesting habitat. It's gonna take a whole lot more than that to fix a lot of problems and to suspend some of the changes that are continuing to go on around us if we want to continue hunting. It's gonna take some sacrifice on everybody's part. And you know, and that's why I am just so, Bradley, I am so vehemently opposed to person or persons as a group that come out with all this divisive rhetoric. I hate them. I despise them. They're worse than anti-hunters.
When you hear anyone say that, well, we've got enough habitat, we don't need to focus on that, I can't talk to that person. Because I can't see, I don't understand how anyone can say that, look at the number, the amount of habitat loss, and say, well, we've got plenty of habitat, the habitat's fine. It's not a popular opinion. It's not a popular opinion, but I've read a survey recently that among groups of hunters, waterfowlers are the most likely to belong to a conservation organization. 47% of duck hunters belong to one conservation organization or another.
Or both.
That's
or
not
both.
Enough.
Yeah.
That's not enough in my book.
It's not enough.
You know, any duck hunter out there that doesn't belong to DU or Delta or one of their state or local conservation organization and actively letting their dollars put something back really needs to rethink where they are, because your license you have to buy, your stamp you have to buy, and it does give something back. But we all need to go into our own pockets and help, like you said, at least stem some of the loss, if not replace some of what we're losing. Or
if not money, time. You know what I'm saying? Because you know, most of these national wildlife refuges, they have refuge groups comprised of local citizens that become active, at least vocal, that show up to meetings and talk, you know, or write your congressman a letter and ask for funding for something important that benefits the waterfowl. I mean, there's a lot of different ways, but become active. If you don't have tons of money, become active in a conservation group, you know what I'm saying?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I've heard the excuse before, you know, and I'm not saying everybody has a huge disposable income, but a $25 or $30 membership to a conservation organization, that's a couple boxes of shells. Let's be real about it. An extra duck stamp, that's a couple of boxes of shells. It's not like they're asking you to spend thousands of dollars. If you can't say, I'm going to shoot two less shells per hunt and give $30 to a conservation organization, I don't understand that logic. You know,
yeah,
we have all got to do something. We've all got to do something. And like you said, pointing fingers and pointing blame and trying to find the easy excuse isn't going to make duck hunting better for anybody.
No. And duck, you know, I always say the world's a lot bigger than our backyard, and duck hunting, you know, especially in North America, where we have a continental migration, and those waterfowl from the Arctic or Prairie Canada all the way down to the Gulf Coast have life cycle requirements that must be met. It's much bigger than our backyard. It's much bigger than our hunting area. It's much bigger than our duck blind. And, you know, I hear it, golly, just in the last 6 months, you know, hunting in Uruguay has been shut down. New Zealand is under attack right now. They're fighting liberals tooth and nail to keep hunting. If you don't think that politically that hunting is hanging by a thread right here in the United States of America, you've got a sad reality coming up, buddy. I'm telling you, there are entities that want to shut down hunting right now. Now is the time that we. I don't care if you're an Arkansas public land hunter, an out of state Mississippi Turkey. I don't care who you are. We have got to close the ranks and pull together and hang in this thing together. You know what I'm saying? Because we're, you know, if it's important to you that your kids and grandkids continue to hunt like you do it right now, we better start building team instead of fractionalizing for our own self interest. I'm seeing it all over the world. This thing we do is under attack and is struggling to find its economic and political relevance. You know what I'm saying? And all this infighting and pointing fingers, it's got to cease, or we're all going to sink with the boat. We're all on the same boat together. You know what I'm saying? And that's just, you know, not to preach and be like that, but I feel very strong about it. I ask myself, you know, where are my kids going to be? If I've raised them to be hunters. Where are they going to be if hunting doesn't exist? Where am I going to be if I can't go out and hunt? You know, I mean, we need this thing. You know, I believe, not to sound stupid, but I believe wildlife needs us to give them commodity value and to manage them collectively and to that they continue to persist beyond just an observational value, you know, besides just, you know, being able to go out to the edge of a pier and look at ducks behind a clothes on and say, yeah, there's a few ducks. That's a gadwall. If we want to enjoy this thing and see skies full of ducks, we've got to work together. But because time, you know, the population ain't ceasing to grow. You know, another 25 years, a lot will be 15 billion people on Earth that need feeding. You know,
one of the things that someone pointed out to me once, as far as is what we as hunters need to realize on the conservation element is, yeah, there are people that aren't hunters that say they appreciate wildlife, but a bird watcher looks for rarity, whereas hunters look for abundance. So people who want to appreciate wildlife, they want to see the rarest one. They want to see the unique animal. We as sportsmen want to see an abundance. We want to see the population of wild game that we take from thrive. That's our goal. And that goal can't be met if we're fighting against each other.
I mean, we want to build a big bank account and draw from the interest. You know, it's very, very rare that we have anti-hunters come into our social media platforms, but we just had one. Just a couple of days ago, I think she's a lady. Of course, she's just another anonymous, you know, entity out there that comes onto our page and snipes. But you know, my message is, hey, you know, you get the luxury of enjoying all this wildlife because we hunters are footing the bill. You know, through our time and through our money and through our interest and the commodity value and everything else. So either join us, and that doesn't mean you have to go kill them. Either join us in it or sit quietly on the sidelines. And that's what I tell anybody, any other little loudmouth on the internet that's got a divisive agenda. Go back to the sidelines and sit quietly. Or join us in building something better and making this world a better place. It sounds ugly, but that's just what my thoughts are. You know, but you're right. We do want to see an abundance of it.
Guys, what a great show. I don't think that, could have been broken down by two. I don't think it could have been broken down any better by two people. It was a great conversation.
Well, I enjoyed it. It's a topic that's clearly very dear to my heart and dear to Ramsey's and to anybody that's in the waterfowling or in the outdoors world. I think it's worth talking about. And people may say we've heard this stuff before, but it's worth hearing again until people start listening and paying attention.
And Rocky, I'd like to hear other people weigh in on what's changed and what can be done collectively. You know, us working together. I don't got all the answers. You know, but I'd love to hear some of these other all salts weigh in on this subject because I think it's very important. I think, you know, like somebody said one time, if you don't like the topic, change the discussion. Well, you know what? With all that happened with that group down there. All that hatred and divisive rhetoric coming out of that part of the world, it's up to us to change the subject.
That's right.
And
you're right.
So, you know, and you've had a lot of very knowledgeable and well-informed and well-traveled and experienced people on this podcast already. And I guarantee you they could take any list that was put together and add to it and give it depth. So, you know, I think it's a topic we need to keep up, or y'all need to keep up.
Well, you know, just in 22 years, I had three or four different groups that hunted from day one to the very end at Mossy Island Outfitters. And I can remember them saying every year that they came in, man, this place is just, this changed. You know, it went from tons of habitat in the mid to late 90s to looking like the surface of the moon right there around Morgan City where I was. That's a big change in 22 years, 21 years. Mm-hmm. And if you can't look up and see the changes in your area and you still think that hot cropping is the number one thing that's changing the migration of waterfowl, like that. But enjoyed it today, guys. Thank you again for being here. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast powered by DuckSouth.com.